The matter of State versus Randy Manning. Can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Miller, please go ahead.
I'd like to request 2 minutes time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
May it please the court. This case is about exigency, and the state submits that at approximately 7:39 p.m. on August 16, 2011, the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office faced one. Prior to that moment, at around 8 a.m., a body executed via gunshot and found burned beyond recognition in an abandoned SUV was found on a residential street. The ensuing investigation was complex, immediate, and geographically dispersed. Of note, the abandoned SUV was searched pursuant to a warrant. Investigators identified the victim as Rian Stout using a fingerprint and obtained his cell phone location data. And teams of detectives were sent to Brooklyn to interview Stout's family and friends. In the early evening, as information poured into headquarters from all directions, investigators realized that the evidence pointed at defendant. He had told a witness that he was with Stout the prior day, which was impossible given Stout's cell phone records. He was the last person known to be with Stout. His face was depicted on a fake license found near the driver's seat in the abandoned SUV. When that evidence was pieced together, an immediate need arose for defendant's cell phone records. The records had the power to reveal defendant's exact location, his prior contacts, and confirm whether the phone was actually his. In seeking those records, investigators had reason to fear that any delay presented a danger of violence to others and police or further evidence destruction. Looking at the objective circumstances, the crimes were serious, murder, desecration of human remains, among others. The threat of evidence destruction was real. The suspect had already set in motion a gruesome plan to destroy evidence by burning the body and leaving it in an abandoned vehicle, and it had been moved from the crime scene, and he could return at will. Further evidence destruction was likely, as police had not recovered the murder weapon or the victim's phone. Defendant was actively masking his involvement by lying to others about his and Stout's whereabouts. And if defendant had ever left the residential neighborhood where he abandoned the body and vehicle, his ability to flee was enhanced by his demonstrated access to means of disguising his identity, as demonstrated by the fraudulent license found in the vehicle. The threat of further violence was great. Defendant was likely armed and had just committed murder. Teams of investigators were in imminent danger of encountering him as they canvassed Brooklyn, where defendant lived, and contacted the victim's social circle, of which defendant was involved. And the time it would take to get a warrant would have been substantial. As found by Judge Derajian, these type of warrants take time to compose, and any delay on that part would be in addition to delay from the service provider if the exigent circumstances form was not completed. As determined by the motion court, the state met its burden to show by a preponderance of the evidence that defendant's cell phone's records were obtained pursuant to probable cause and exigent circumstances. On defendant's appeal, the appellate division suppressed they avoided the constitutional question of exigency and looked to the statute. Very briefly, the state submits that the statutory analysis was flawed, as suppression is excluded as a remedy under Section 34 of the Wiretap Act. What the state seeks now is not an armed gunman or a murder exception to the warrant requirement. The state seeks affirmance of the motion court's well-reasoned ruling that police faced a dangerous and fraught situation when they reasonably requested defendant's cell phone records without a warrant. That concludes my opening remarks.
So you're putting the exigency and the fact-based issues to one side. You're relying on what remedies the statute does and does not provide for violations, correct? And your interpretation of Section 34 in particular, which says there's criminal and civil liability but not suppression in this case. Is
That's
that
correct.
Fair? Do you have the language of Section 34 in front of you?
I do. I have one moment.
It says, remedies and sanctions described in the identified sections are the only judicial remedies and sanctions for non-constitutional violations of some other sections. What do you understand the meaning of non-constitutional in the context of this statute, which is speaking about statutory sections, to mean?
The way I read the limitations provision is that when Section 29C4 isn't followed, or any section of Section 29, there's the remedy set forth in the statute, but if the defense seeks suppression, then the traditional exigency analysis that's usually performed when the state argues that exigent circumstances would apply, and the factors set forth in State v. Johnson would be analyzed. The state submits that the statute really doesn't speak to suppression. The statute talks about when cell service providers shall turn over these records. It doesn't purport to limit that these are the only time police can request these records.
I'm asking a slightly different question.
Sure, I apologize if I missed
it. What is the phrase non-constitutional violations mean to you, and perhaps Mr. Murawski can help us as well, in the context of a discussion of these statutory sections? What's the legislature getting at there?
It's hard to tell what circumstances they are referring to, but they're clearly not referring to these circumstances before the court. They're talking about perhaps when these sections, which is not only Section 29, are violated in a criminal sense as provided there, or in the civil sense to seek some economic advantage, then the remedies provisions would apply. But if there's a constitutional question, these statutes are not really purported to address that.
Is there a constitutional issue if there is a Fourth Amendment violation or a violation of the state constitutional provision on search and seizure? If we're completely in the common law or completely under the constitutional analysis, the statute weren't there, and there's found to be a violation of the defendant's constitutional rights, isn't suppression a remedy under the statute?
Yes, then the suppression would. The state submits if there weren't exigent circumstances, then suppression would be a remedy. But suppression is not a remedy that's provided under the statute. It'd be a remedy that's available under constitutional principles.
I take it that your exigent circumstances argument is premised on a constitutional challenge, and you are not challenging the constitutional challenge itself, are you?
No, I'm not challenging that. Okay. There's an argument the defense is making that there's not an exigency, and if that argument accepted, then the records would be suppressed.
You're accepting that as of the date of these events in, 2011, that Article 1, Paragraph 7 protected cell call records and also cell data records?
Yes.
Okay. So the whole issue is you stand or fall with exigency.
That's correct. You know, the argument that the exigent circumstances exception within the statute wasn't followed and then automatically suppression must apply, that wasn't even really presented to the appellate division. The way the appellate division used the statute was really raised sua sponte. And the state would like to note that in the appellate decision, they don't even discuss the limitation on remedies that's the exclusivity of remedies provision in Section 34. And the state submits that that's really telling that a mistake was made by the appellate division.
And that's why you conceded that there was a flawed statutory analysis in the appellate division's decision. I think you said that right in your initial presentation, correct?
That's correct. That's been conceded.
So then let's talk about exigency. Can we look at the totality of the circumstances during the investigation to assess whether this was a matter of exigency?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then look to the very end. Days after the murder, there's a telephone conversation with the defendant on the 18th, and the police don't run out to grab him, find him, talk to him immediately. They allow him to come in by public transportation the next day on his own?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
How does that comport with the notion that these were exigent circumstances throughout the investigation?
You know, what happened once these records were received wasn't really covered at the motion hearing. Defense counsel asked the questions of the detective based on that conversation that happened, really to get at the point that it would have been more reasonable for the detective to just call defendant's number once he had it, rather than making this exigent circumstances request for the cell phone records. But the state submits that, it wasn't addressed, but the detectives were looking for a defendant the entire time. But once the days had passed, we don't know what else occurred during this investigation. No other bodies had been found. And once defendant reached out to police and volunteered to come in, the state submits that it was reasonable police decision to allow him to come in at that point.
How does that comport with your argument that earlier, when there would have been less evidence against him, that he's armed with a gun, he's a danger to the police, he's a danger to the public, but now he calls up, oh, you're taking public transportation? See you when you get here. I'm trying to understand the first part of your argument, this exigency, and this sort of, okay, come in when you can on public transportation. It doesn't seem to jive.
Yes, well, the state submits that it would have been reasonable to allow a defendant to come in once he volunteered that he'd be willing to come in. It also would have been reasonable for police to go search for him in that moment.
How do you know he wouldn't have been, had they contacted him, he wouldn't have been willing to come in from the beginning?
Well, initially the state submits that the records reveal that his cell phone was turned off. And once days had passed, the exigency eventually dissipates. After days had gone by and they hadn't found any further victims, at this point, it's reasonable for police to allow them to come in. The focus of the exigency analysis is traditionally on the circumstances known to the police once they make the request. This record didn't really cover how police were looking for him the entire time. But once the police also made the exigency request, it was revealed that defendant's phone was turned off. Police couldn't have even called him if they tried.
In the record, is it established how much time it would have taken to secure an affidavit for the cell site records?
In the judge's decision, he submits that these type of warrants take time.
I know that's what he said. Okay, that's what he's... I'm talking about now in the evidence, not what the judge said on his own. And we don't know what that's even based on. In the record, did you submit any information on the amount of time that it would have taken to secure one of these warrants?
We did not submit the testimony from Detective Frazier was that it would have taken too long to write these moments to write for him to write a communications data warrant based on his evaluation of the circumstances. And the record does include that a specific time wasn't set forth. And how long it takes to compose a communications data warrant really varies on the circumstances. But the record does include a communications data warrant. It's included in, it was moved into evidence, and it's included in defendant's appellate appendix. And you can tell by looking at it that these aren't simple warrants to create. They're more complicated. There's a lot of, discrete terminology used. And Judge Jurajian's finding was based on the fact that he is a communications data warrant judge and has experience in how long it takes to draft them. It wasn't...
Help us understand this. August 16th, evening hours, the state tells us there wasn't time to get a warrant because this suspect was armed and considered extremely dangerous and posed a threat to law enforcement. 48 hours later, it appears from the police conduct, they no longer believe that. What happened?
What
justifies the difference in approach?
Sure. What police did once they got these records, it wasn't really developed at the motion hearing. The focus, and I submit reasonably, the assistant prosecutor focused on all the circumstances leading up to the detective's determination the situation was exigent. They didn't cover how hard they looked through Brooklyn for him once they got these records. The records didn't reveal the GPS location, so they didn't have an exact location. But that avenue wasn't really pursued by defense counsel either. They just raised the phone call days later.
Slightly different question. Why is he armed and extremely dangerous and a threat to law enforcement on the 16th but not on the 18th?
Well, what's in the record, the evidence shows that no further bodies were found. Days had passed without any further violence. And looking at what happens after the fact, the state submits isn't really the heart of the exigent circumstances analysis. It's what happens before. If there had been a murder over that two-day period, an additional murder, the state wouldn't be able to point to that as evidence that the situation was exigent at the time Detective Frazier or Detective...
I thought you said at the outset that the totality of the investigation could be considered is Is that no longer your position?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question when you asked that. I didn't understand that you meant facts known to police after they requested the exigent circumstances. The state submits that the exigency analysis is what police know at the time. And this hearing, you know, the hearing wasn't developed about what police did afterwards. It wasn't contested that police were combing Brooklyn.
We can't consider the warrants that were obtained immediately afterwards, warrants before, warrants afterwards. Why don't you tell us how many warrants were obtained?
There was a CDW for the four telephone numbers that was submitted on the 19th. And additionally, there was a wiretap.
Four. So start with the first warrant, the second warrant. I want to see how difficult it was for the prosecutor's office to get these warrants.
Sure.
And give us the dates.
Okay, the exigent circumstance request form was set on 7:39 p.m. On the 16th. Earlier that day, there was a search warrant drafted for the automobile that was found that was signed at around 1:20 p.m.
There was no difficulty getting a judge.
No, there was not any difficulty getting the judge for that at that moment. But the delay, it's not with the CDWs. It's not only the delay.
I've asked you, tell us about the. Would there were other warrants?
Sure. The record reveals that at 9:15 p.m. after the next day after the exigent circumstances form was sent out, then a CDW was signed, and I believe a wiretap order was signed as well for additional information.
Was there any problem securing a judge at that hour?
The record doesn't show that there was any problem. No.
And do we know how long it took to produce that CDW?
That's not in the record, is how long it took exactly.
At the time that the request was made to the telecommunication carrier and where you didn't apply for the warrant, was it known to the police that the defendant's picture was on that driver's license found in the car?
Absolutely. I think the record is very clear that police knew that they had looked up Manning's information once they got a phone number associated with him and his name. They found a photograph of him in a government database, and Detective Frazier testified at a couple points in the transcript that he only requested the exigent circumstances form after he matched that, he recognized that face from the license that was found near the driver's seat that was found in the car. And that number was also verified. It was a number they got from Brian Dunbar. They also spoke to Stout's mother to make sure that was Manning's number as well.
Your adversaries are arguing that this is, you're engaged in generalized assumptions, and you're looking for like a murder exception. And they're saying that you're not able to look to specific articulable facts in this case rather than generalized assumptions as to his danger to the public, immediate danger to the public, and immediate danger to law enforcement. And then they go through examples. Carpenter, you know, if it's a terrorism case, it's one thing. If it's a serial murder, it's another. How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, the state submits that we're not looking for a murder exception. We're not looking for an armed gun exception. There's discrete facts evidencing a plan of evidence destruction that was set in motion. The police had no idea where the crime scene was, allowing the defendant to return. The body had been burned and moved from the crime scene, burned to police reasonably assumed to hide his identity.
What is there other than that? There's evidence that he killed someone, that he's going to kill other people, that he's on a rampage, or what? Is there any evidence other than a completed crime?
Well, the state submits that it's more than just a murder that took place here. The act that was committed here to cover up the crime was absolutely terrifying. The body was burned to the fourth degree and left on a residential street. Police did not even know.
No one's minimizing that. Okay, so there was a murder, and the murderer does not want people to find out that he's the murderer. Okay. What is there to believe that he is going to commit other crimes?
The state submits that burning the body demonstrates, you know, quite gruesomely the lengths he would go to avoid capture. But he's been seen by the witness who saw the car being dropped off at 4:20 a.m. He's seen leaving on foot from that car in a residential area. Police didn't even know There's nothing in the record that reveals that he had even ever left that area or how he got out of that area. There's no recovery of the gun. There's no recovery of the victim's cell phone. Police are canvassing Brooklyn looking for Stout's family and friends, of which defendant was one, and were very likely to run into him. He likely still had the firearm when they did. And, you know, there's based on the nature of the murder.
How can we know that he still had the firearm? I mean, isn't that a little bit of speculation?
Well, the alternative is that he discarded it and perhaps in a place where the public could get to it. But it's still reasonable to assume that
he's still. I'm asking the question because I'm trying to understand how do we cabin, if we accept your argument on exigency here, how does it get cabined to the next case where there's a murder and you're arguing, the state is arguing similarly about dangerousness and potential destruction of evidence that without pointing to something imminent or actual that's about to happen, like, you know, drugs being flushed down a toilet behind a closed door when the police are trying to get in. You know, help us here, because it sounds like you're making some generic arguments in favor of both of those points to support exigency.
Well, the fact that there was a murder, the seriousness of the crime, and the fact that the defendant may have been armed, that's always been looked to by this court as serious facts in determining whether there's an exigency. But it's in terms of the additional facts here, the state submits that there's really a lot to work with. That there's the demonstrated destruction of evidence, the demonstrated plan to hide the crime scene from police. He's actively masking his involvement in the crime by lying to other witnesses. Those witnesses may be in danger if defendant realizes that they've spoken to police.
Can I stop you one moment?
Sure.
Because there had been some destruction of evidence, there is imminent risk of other destruction of evidence. Don't you have to point to something that you think is imminently likely to be destroyed or what? I mean, is it just that because there had been some effort to conceal a crime, there's going to be more?
Well, I think there's more than just that one effort that's in the past. I think he had shown that he's continuously masking his involvement. He's lying about where he is to other witnesses. And, you know, he had access to a means of fake ID, so as demonstrated by the ID in the car. So it's very possible that he was going to be able to flee and evade capture. And in terms of the most imminent fact that state submits here is that police were very likely to encounter him at any moment when they were canvassing Brooklyn, where he lives, with people he knows and looking for him.
But this is just the part I'm still trying to understand. You said, again, he's likely to have a handgun, and yet the police speak with him on the phone. He said, I'm taking public transportation. Thank you. See you when you get here. I just don't see the consistency. Can you explain that?
Well, the state emphasizes that that's days later, after they had been searching for him, and the record doesn't reveal what exactly the police learned in the meantime. But, I mean, days had passed by that
point. Did they learn he was less dangerous 2 days later?
Well, as time passes, there's less reason to assume that there's an ongoing plan of violence. And the fact that he called police is indicative of itself to turn himself in is indicative that he would be less of a threat than he is at the time when police
After the fact, where do after the facts learned after the critical moment with regard to exigency fit into the analysis in either direction? And what I mean by that is if, in fact, police had learned days later that the defendant had beaten up a witness or intimidated a witness, threatened a witness. Would that be a fact that you could use to support exigency, even though it happened after the moment when the officers decided to simply make the request?
You know, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the analysis is what the police know and objectively look at that at the time they request.
So you wouldn't be claiming that a later event in either direction is relevant to the totality of the circumstances analysis?
No, if there had been a rash of murders after we requested these records, I don't think it would be fair for the state to say, look now, we were right just by chance. Therefore,
do you know if there's any law on that question, and specifically a law on whether the way in which the investigation unfolds after the fact in, you know, helping one side or the other is relevant to the totality of circumstances exigency analysis?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have a specific case on that.
Please finish your answer.
In looking at the case law, I didn't see any cases in which after the fact events had been used to either validate the exigency or undercut it.
can it be limited so cleanly in time? In this case, you have no application for a warrant at 7:39. Suppose an hour and a half later the police did obtain a warrant for some other aspect. Would that be relevant to the analysis?
Well, I think that would be perhaps useful in evaluating the officer's credibility, that if they said that they didn't have time to make a warrant and then immediately after the record showed that they did have time to make a warrant, I think it would severely undercut the credibility of their initial determinations when they're describing how long it takes to write these. But I don't think it would directly go into the exigency analysis.
Are you telling us that if you had gotten one of these communication data warrants, let's say at 11 p.m., and the defendant was engaged in shooting people at 1 a.m., that you wouldn't be coming before us in arguing that that evidence shows you the dire circumstances in which the police were operating and the reason why it was objectively reasonable for them to secure that data warrant? You wouldn't be looking to that evidence?
I would not be arguing that is. It's to me, the argument or the analysis is what the police know at the time they're making this exigent circumstances request, how it unfolds, and how reasonable their analysis, how it unfolds. I mean, that's a matter of chance. The standard here is a substantial likelihood of evidence being destroyed or the public or police being in danger. We don't have to prove that it actually happened.
Based on your argument for the communication data warrant, would you also argue that the police had a right to search his home without a warrant based on exigent circumstances?
Well, it's tough to say that because the urgency of the search also depends on what we expect the search to uncover. Here, the police requested records that had the power to reveal exactly where defendant was, whether he ever left the neighborhood, who else might have been in danger. I guess the search of the house would depend on, you know, whether there was evidence that he returned there after the crime, or what police knew. It's hard to address that hypothetical, but there's certain circumstances where I submit that it would be exigent.
Are we talking about probable cause for the securing of the communication data warrant? Is that the standard?
Yes, probable cause.
To believe that he was involved in the murder?
I believe with searches, it's probable cause to believe that the evidence of criminality would be uncovered, but the evidence against the defendant is clearly related to that.
You were asked earlier about the breadth of the rule that you're asking for here. It is a factor that distinguishes this case, the extreme nature that this defendant undertook to destroy evidence.
I would submit
burning a body and leaving it in public.
Yes, I think Defense Amicus Briefs talks about this being a garden variety homicide. That isn't really the case in what Bergen County's experienced. The circumstances here were absolutely terrifying, and I think those should be considered by the court in later determining the lengths police went in avoiding delay in trying to locate defendant and avoid further violence or evidence destruction.
Is it your contention that the combination of factors that appeared at the time, the body being burned, left in a residential area where anybody could have walked in on this situation, obviously the presence of a fake ID showing that the defendant had some wherewithal, intensified the officer's concern that the next thing that the defendant might do to avoid being incriminated in this crime is start knocking off some of the witnesses who he knew had relevant information?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. Or even, you know, confront violently with police. He's gone to demonstrated lengths to avoid taking any responsibility for this crime. And I think it's very reasonable.
The co-defendant identifying him as being with the victim the night of the alleged murder. So it's not like the police didn't have information from other people knowledgeable about the defendant and about the victim and the existence of a relationship between them.
Yes, the evidence that the police had at that point strongly suggested that, if not the culprit, defendant had information about what had happened.
Were there other suspects that had not been ruled out still at that point?
Nothing was shown in the record about other suspects that were being considered by the detectives at this point.
So you can represent that the state had focused all of their attention on this defendant when they made this exigent application?
Yes, I can represent that. The investigation was still ongoing. Teams of detectives were still out canvassing Brooklyn. But here detectives were following the information, and that information was pointing at one suspect, and that was the only defendant.
You were asked whether there was a showing at the hearing of what specific evidence was, in the view of the officers, in danger of being destroyed. In the immediate aftermath of this offense, were the officers in a position to know what the evidence might be that was out there that could possibly be destroyed?
Absolutely not, especially when defendant had gone to lengths to hide the crime scene from police. The ability of defendant to return there at will is a significant factor.
So if you were to, and you were asked by Justice Slovakia about cabining in this case versus other cases. You've obviously stated that this is not you're not asking for a murder exception to the warrant requirement for this type of warrant or any other. What is the principle that differentiates this case from other murder cases?
I would suggest to Your Honor that it's the demonstrated evidence destruction, the gruesome nature of the evidence destruction, the evidence that defendant was ongoing in his efforts to hide his involvement, the evidence that suggested that he had access of means to enhance his ability to flee, as well the existence of the firearm that had not been recovered. Basically, you know, the overwhelming evidence in this case led police to reasonably conclude that the delay in obtaining the warrant and writing the warrant and having the service provider respond to that warrant would continue what they had already known to have occurred.
And the delay was what? We don't know. An hour, let's say, 2 hours, maybe less, if they could get it from a telephone warrant, 45 minutes, we don't even know. And you're saying that period of time is the breaking point, even though you can't identify destruction of what evidence or any particular individual who would be endangered?
There is no testimony on the amount of time of delay on the service provider's end, but the state submits that the existence of the exigent circumstances form in of itself, which requires the officer to swear that there is an exigency in order to get these records, which came in 20 minutes, it strongly suggests that there is going to be a longer delay if they don't go through that procedure. And this detective may not have known what the delay may have been. There's a number of service providers, and their willingness to cooperate with police, it varies. So he may not have known, but it just may have been a chance that it would have been extremely long that, in his determination, made getting the warrant and then hoping the cell service provider would honor their request to put a rush order on compiling this information.
Wasn't that one of the issues, that it wasn't so much, it was in part certainly the time to get the warrant and present it to a judge, but much longer period of time that these warrants typically are handled by, I guess, counsel's consulted, and the records are actually obtained. Wasn't that the time period that was most at issue?
That time period is definitely at issue.
No, wasn't that the one that they emphasized? They talked about the time that it would take.
When they talk about the time they take, it is emphasized. I'm not sure if it's emphasized more than the time it would take to compose the CDW. Detective Frazier just talks about the delay just being too long.
There's mention about the firearm. He's out there with a gun. We don't know where it is. He's already tried to destroy the body. The gun was with a friend. When did they find that out, and when, if at all, was the gun actually recovered? I don't remember seeing that.
The gun was never recovered. Yeah. The trial record reveals that it was never found.
They learn that it was apparently given to a friend.
That some of the statements indicate that. Some of those statements were later recanted. It's not really clear where the gun ended up. But based on your questions about the service provider's delay, the state emphasizes that some of the evidence that was requested, the cell phone records, was prospective. The GPS ping that the police requested, that evidence could have changed at any moment. The phone event turned out to be off, so the self-service provider wasn't able to ping defendant's home and provide police with his exact location. But that's something that was very temporal, and if the police didn't request it, they may not have been there later, or there may have been a different location later, or the phone may have been disposed of.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add at this point?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Murawski?
It pleases the court. The Attorney General agrees with the state that this is a constitutional question. The defendant has asked, he asserts a constitutional violation of the warrant requirement, and he asks for suppression. However, the defendant refuses to acknowledge that if he's asking for a constitutional suppression because of a constitutional violation, constitutional exceptions to that warrant requirement also apply, and the exigent circumstances exception does apply to this constitutional violation. This is not a statutory case.
Mr. Ross, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, can you explain when under Section 29, in an alleged violation of Section 29, do you look at statutory as opposed to constitutional remedies?
Well, if the statute isn't followed to the letter, then that would trigger the potential for those statutory remedies of civil remedies and criminal remedies. But one thing is for certain, the constitutional remedy of suppression does not obtain for a statutory violation unless the legislature made it clear that it would, and they're fully capable of doing that when they want to.
So that's what I'm struggling with. You have a statute, you have arguably a violation of that statute, and remedies in the statute. At what point do you say, we're not going to look at that, we're going to instead consider a constitutional framework? Where's the dividing line?
Well, when the police observe the Constitution, we're not saying here that the police had to, they satisfied this by having reasonable grounds. We're saying they had probable cause and they had exigent circumstances. They satisfied the constitutional requirement that's existed throughout, that existed at the time of this search, that the police need, if they want a search without a warrant, they need probable cause and exigent circumstances. And they had that here.
You understand I'm not asking about the facts of this case. I'm trying to understand what is a little unusual language in a statute that doesn't say violations of this statute call for ... It says non-constitutional violations call for that.
Well, a violation of the statute, but a violation of the letter of the statute is technically a non-constitutional violation. It's a statutory violation. If that violation also violates the Constitution, then you have to look at constitutional remedies as a constitutional violation. They exist as two separate tracks. They're not mutually exclusive. You don't pigeonhole it. It's either statutory or constitutional. It could be both at the same time. If you're trying to satisfy a statute, you also have to satisfy the Constitution.
So it would be a technical violation of the statute that doesn't implicate the Fourth Amendment or state constitutional rights of the defendant.
No, it does not. It only might affect his statutory rights, but those statutory rights are only protected by statutory remedies. You don't protect statutory rights with constitutional remedies.
If his statutory rights are violated because there was an error or a intentional violation of the statute, why is that not always a constitutional violation?
Well, first of all, here we would say that the statute was followed. There was exigent circumstances, because the Constitution sets a minimal behavior from the police, it sets a requirement of police behavior that the violation of which brings with it the rather drastic remedy of suppressing evidence found as a result. Statutes that are violated don't necessarily
get that. Now, I get that as a general proposition, but what's difficult to envision here is what. If the statute was violated and defendant's rights under the statute were violated, the defendant is there's got to be a search and seizure implication to that, isn't there? Or is there
only
some other aspect
of the Constitution in addition to the statute?
Because there could be violations by the carrier and other parties that would not necessarily they would violate the statute's procedures, but not necessarily be a state constitutional violation.
But I'm trying to get this straight, because I think you're making a very straightforward argument.
Yeah.
You are not challenging the fact that in 2011, Article 1, Paragraph 7, applied not only to the securing of phone data, but also cell site data. You're not contesting that,
no.
Correct?
But also the exceptions to that constitutional requirement.
No, I understand. You're arguing that exigent circumstances apply, and if they were present, there's no constitutional violation.
And I also note that I think the ACLU in this case actually agrees with us that the proper analysis is the exigent circumstances analysis.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Murawski? You said they have probable cause. Are you saying they had probable cause to arrest this individual?
They had a well-grounded suspicion that he was involved in the murder. Yes, they did have probable cause to arrest him. He was lying about his whereabouts. He had obviously had a murder, and you had someone who had was with him, was suspected to being with the victim. The sheer fact that he's lying about his whereabouts and having said that he was with him and that he had access to the defendant certainly is a strong indication that there's probable cause to suspect him in this murder.
I ask that question because we're dealing with a situation where you're looking for location data about an individual. Not you, the state is looking for location data. And, you know, in Earls, we said we're imposing a warrant requirement because we think that's what the Constitution requires here in New Jersey, but we acknowledge an exigency exception. So what does the probable cause piece have to show? Is it enough to focus enough attention of proof of criminality by that individual in order to justify location data? It can't just be, I don't think, because I'm having trouble logically making this connection, that there might be evidence of criminality on him, or I'm having trouble connecting the destruction of evidence piece to the probable cause requirement for exigency.
He left a fake license in the car, and it wasn't his car, it was the victim's car, and he left the fake license in there. He's lying about his whereabouts. Certainly that's highly suspicious that he's involved. Whether he was the actual shooter or not, perhaps they don't know that for sure, but they know.
I'm not trying to engage you about the facts in this case. I'm trying to understand the level of evidence that should be present to allow for recognition of the exigency circumstances for location data and avoid the warrant requirement. Because it seems to me simply pointing to the potential destruction of evidence by someone doesn't meet one part of the exigency analysis.
Well, I think that it's rather clear that the exigency, the destruction of the evidence would be by this particular defendant. It was this particular defendant that lied about being with the victim and lied about his whereabouts. This particular defendant, which left his fake ID into the victim's car, it's reasonable to focus on this particular defendant.
And we've got to make, do you agree that we need to make the focus on why the location data, the location of this individual is essential to the probable cause determination? Because it's not like exigency to go search this individual's house. It's to find him.
It's to find him. And in fact, it's also objective in the circumstances that he could have been in danger as well, or someone else could have been in danger. Like people were talking about, who else could have been in danger? Certainly Mr. Dunbar, who had given information that was kind of damaging to the defendant. He was a witness to the defendant's lies. He could have been in danger. There was a witness who seen someone walking away from the car.
So are you agreeing with me then that there has to be a very pointed exigency probable cause analysis in order to justify avoiding the warrant requirement for cell phone data information?
It has to be particularized, certainly.
Isn't the test, and tell me if I'm mistaken, there has to be an objectively reasonable basis to believe that in the time that it would take to get a warrant, there's an objectively reasonable basis to believe that the particular defendant will destroy evidence or cause harm to someone. That's the standard, correct?
Certainly.
Isn't there an additional factor here? Is it not simply just a warrant to go in and search a home, but there's going to be a responder on the other side who's got a team of lawyers who are going to get involved in this. So it's the time it would... in this situation, would be the time it would take to get a warrant, execute the warrant, and then get a response, because that's the unknown.
Right. And I know something's been said about, well, you got a warrant earlier. You got a warrant for the car earlier. That's not necessarily exactly the same as getting the communications warrant later. And the response to this form was only 20 minutes. One thing that we could be fairly confident of, the warrant would not have been obtained and responded to in 20 minutes. So we know for a fact that this applying for this exigent circumstances form provided a tangible benefit in time. And at the time that that form was submitted, the circumstances were objectively exigent. Someone was shot in the head at least once. He was shot four times. The body was burned. So you have.
If that was true, then why didn't they grab him immediately when they found his location?
All that happened after the fact. Plus, I think Mr. Miller's correct in that the record wasn't developed in that regard. I mean, maybe the police say, all right, you want to walk to the police station? You want to go to the police station? Who knows what plans they had for him on his way to the police station? Maybe they were going to jump him on his way there. We don't know what was going to transpire on the way.
See, that's all sort of guessing. Most murders are really, really gruesome. Many of them are. So then the question is, when does a warrant kick in? And the question is, in the time that it would take to get a warrant, do you have particularized information that would create an objectively reasonable basis to believe that someone in particular is in danger or that some piece of evidence will be destroyed? And like, where in the record has that been developed?
Well, it was developed in the record that this individual violently killed somebody who he was suspected of possibly violently killing somebody he considered to be his cousin, and he tried to burn the body. And then he obviously was someone who's deceptive because he had a fake license in the car. He lied about being with him. You don't know what other lies he's lying about. And if he's lying about that stuff, and he's trying to destroy a body, then he would try to destroy a gun.
Is there any requirement on the state to identify the witnesses who are in danger or identify the specific evidence at a point when this is evolving, it's moving very quickly, and they're just at the beginning of their investigation?
No, it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, but I mean, it's different from, I'm not saying proof beyond a reasonable doubt, because I think some of the questions have really characterize the test as you have to identify who, you didn't tell who was in danger. You didn't tell what was in danger in terms of evidence.
That would be too restrictive of a test for exigent circumstances. When life could be at stake, that's too restrictive to say, we need this named person to be in danger by this threat. The fact that someone commits this murder, and it's inexplicable. It was someone who he considered to be his cousin. He tries to burn the body. He abandons it in a residential neighborhood. He's obviously not thinking clearly. It's reasonable to suspect that he's a danger on the loose.
The argument you make, wouldn't every murder provide for exigent circumstances? Every single murder, you don't know who did it. They're trying to hide the murder. They may have a weapon, the murder weapon.
Not necessarily.
You see any situations where exigent circumstances wouldn't apply in any murder investigation?
No, so suppose it was just someone shot somebody and walked away. That might not necessarily implicate the burning of a body.
Well, he walked away, so he's trying to hide his identity.
It's not quite the same as burning a body. It's not quite the same as actually, lying to your friends and the victim's friends about your location, about someone who has a fake identity.
Most people say, I didn't do it. It wasn't me.
Well, we're asking for a totality of circumstances test, which is an objective test at the time the application was made. It would be fact sensitive. And I don't think this case is a garden variety murder. This case is an attempt to destroy the body. We don't see too many cases where the body itself is being totally destroyed. They were attempting to destroy this evidence totally. There was a fake ID in there. That's indication that
many murder cases, I won't say most, engage some form of cover-up. The person who commits the crime is trying not to get caught. This discards the gun, may rub out the fingerprints, lie to people. That is common.
He's actively in the process of doing that. It's not like he could. He's actively in the process of trying to destroy evidence. It's not like, well, he theoretically might want to do that. No, he's actually trying to do that here. He's in the midst of doing it.
So you're saying that a gasoline fire in a residential neighborhood in a car is a very extreme measure to take in the immediate aftermath of a crime.
It is an extreme measure. Someone who you consider to be your cousin, and they're getting shot, and the medical examiner confirmed that too, that this person was shot before they were burned, and that we know that this individual's lying. How many times do the police have in a garden variety murder evidence that he's lying about having been with the victim? We know that ties him into the victim, and we know that he's actively trying to conceal actually physical evidence. And I just want to point out a case to this court when under similar circumstances in State versus Minniti, when the fact that there's gunmen on the loose and that a gun is unaccounted for was considered highly exigent circumstances. Here there's a gunman on the loose, a gun is unaccounted for. Those are highly exigent circumstances. Now, we're not suggesting that that alone meets the test. We adhere to the totality of circumstances test, objective test, at the time the application is made, but those are two very highly exigent circumstances. They should not be diminished. They're not just one factor among many. They are extremely powerful circumstances that should be prominently mentioned in every case. But of course you look at the entire case, and when you look at the entire case here, for the reasons Mr. Miller discussed and I discussed, it is very exigent. And the state is concerned about the notion that what happened after the fact is dispositive. It's not much different than a search and seizure. The products of a search, whether the evidence turns up or it doesn't, never matters. It never matters. The same thing is true for an exigent circumstances test. You don't do an exigent circumstances analysis by saying, oh, you know, we learned a couple hours later it wasn't really that exigent. It's the exigencies that exist at the time. The time that the analysis takes...
Are you saying it's not relevant? I heard you say not dispositive. Okay, that sounds reasonable. Are you saying you would never appear before this court and argue that events immediately afterwards shine light on the exigency that occurred when the application was made?
If those events were totally unforeseen and unpredictable, that would be, I would imagine the court wouldn't allow the state to make that argument. But if the events were foreseeable,
I'm asking you, would you make the argument?
Well, it's in the facts. It would be a factual, it would be elicited in the facts what transpired, of course. But we would not be saying that those aren't the make or break circumstances.
I get it, but I'm just asking you whether or not you would, that would be a factor.
It would be a very small factor. It wouldn't override the more important pre-existing factors. And it's very similar to what a search turns up.
You would try, but you would fail.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, but it's what a search turns up. I mean, if we said, well, of course the search was good, the police found the evidence, I'd be laughed out of court. Same is true for the opposite. The police do the search and didn't find what they were looking for, but they found something else, as long as it was reasonable when they acted. That's the test for probable cause. That's the test for a search and seizure. It's the test for exigency, and it's an objective test.
And it is frozen in time.
It is frozen in time.
I have one more question for you, and that is, what is the process by which a CDW could be applied for by phone? There's been a reference here. Obviously, no one could possibly know what a process exactly to the minute would take, but if you had a judge on call, the affidavit's prepared. Would the affidavit be actually fully prepared, and then the call is made to the judge, and the affidavit is read to the judge?
There's a review process. Attorneys get involved, and then there's standards have to be met, and then it's a process that. It's somewhat unpredictable as to exactly how long it's going
to
take.
I was just focusing on one aspect of it, because if you have the time to go to see a judge, you have a written affidavit, the judge reviews the affidavit. On a telephone warrant with complicated affidavits, what's the process to convey the information that's in the affidavits to the judge? Are they read?
I believe it's read to the judge over the phone, and then after the fact, the affidavit.
So the affidavit would be fully prepared,
yes.
But then read to the judge. You can't skip...
No, you can't.
The preparation of the affidavit just because it's by phone.
Yeah, a full affidavit that's signed by the officer, reviewed by at least one attorney, and so it's not a process where you just dial a judge's number and you're in business. It would not. I mean, we don't know exactly how long it would have taken, but I'm comfortable to say it would have been more than the 20 minutes that the exigent circumstances.
Are you saying that a police officer cannot call up a judge when there are circumstances requiring an immediate warrant, get sworn in over the telephone and convey the information?
My understanding is that an attorney has to be involved in that decision, that an attorney has to be called first.
Are you aware of any wiretap warrant being given over the phone ever?
Oh, no, they're usually, it's usually a very
formal. I'm asking, are you aware of that ever happening?
Actually, I can't say with 100% certainty. I'm not aware of it, no.
That's all I'm asking.
I can't say for 100% certainly that never happened, but it's definitely not the preferred practice, and it wouldn't have been the practice.
You see a lot of these, I assume, coming through your office, and you've dealt with a lot of them?
Right. No, I don't work so much with the wiretaps, but I've seen a number of them.
Have you ever seen one that was done over the phone?
I have not, myself.
This isn't a wiretap, though.
It's a CDW.
A CDW.
But it's a process that it would have taken longer than 20 minutes. And if exigent circumstances, and if assuming if exigent circumstances is present, 20 minutes is a lot better than that warrant would have taken. If evidence was in jeopardy of being destroyed, if life hung in the balance, 20 minutes is a lot better than what a warrant would give you. And that's a tangible difference. And plus, we don't know how long that warrant would be. So that warrant that was obtained after the fact is really quite irrelevant. And, you know, judges don't always drop what they're doing to address these. Sometimes, you know, you have to get in line with what's going on, what the judge is doing that day. This is during, I think, close to the work time. And there's no guarantee that warrants take X amount of time. And I don't think that the warrant for the car is necessarily dispositive. And even still, that warrant for the car took a couple hours. This form took 20 minutes, and 20 minutes is a lot better. And under an exigent set of circumstances, we would want a form that gets that evidence to the police in 20 minutes rather than wait for however long a warrant might take. And for those reasons, the Attorney General asks that we reverse the Appellate Division's ruling, which was not actually presented to them by either party or briefed, to address the exigent circumstances argument and to reverse the Appellate Division and affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you. Ms. Perrone.
Your Honors, I think Justice Albin summarized exactly what's going on in this case when he said that this case involves a murder and a murderer who doesn't want anyone to know he was the murderer. That's this case. That's presumably most, if not all, other murder cases. That can't be enough for exigency. There's no limiting principle in what the state is asking this court to do. It can't be that there was a burned body. That can't be our limiting principle. The limiting principle has to be a true, actual exigency. And it is the state's burden to prove that exigency. So when the state speculates to this court about the amount of time it may have taken to get a warrant, they should have established that on the record. There was never any evidence in this record where the cop said, I made this decision because I knew it was going to take X amount of hours to get a warrant, and I couldn't take that time to do it. It's also 20 minutes isn't really the relevant time period here. At 4:30 in the afternoon, the police learned they had spoken to the witness or the friend in New York, in Brooklyn, and the police had learned that there was some information that the defendant had spoken to this person, had given inconsistent information. The police looked at the picture. They developed some of their suspicions about the defendant. That was at 4:30 in the afternoon. They requested at 7:39 p.m., they requested exigent circumstances information from the phone carrier. We don't know what happened during those 3 hours. We don't know why a warrant could not have been obtained during those 3 hours.
I'm sorry. What's your position with respect to after-the-fact developments, how it all turned out? In either direction, are they in or are they out of the analysis?
I think there is a distinction. On the one hand, you can have after the fact, say someone else had been killed after the fact. That's not going to go back and justify retroactively the exigent circumstances.
And the reason you would argue very strongly on keeping that out is because that was not known to the police at the time.
It's not relevant to what the police knew at the time.
Okay. And so that's the test, is what was relevant to what the police knew at the time.
Right. What we have in this situation is different. We have police making a claim that they believe that there were exigent circumstances. Then we have evidence of how the police acted in the next couple of days that directly cast doubt on the credibility and the validity of that position. We're not trying to introduce some new thing that happened, some new event, like someone being killed. We're saying the way that the police acted in the days following is very inconsistent with the claim that they made.
But are those two analytically any different? Because if events had transpired and there was a second and third murder on the night, and the state was coming into saying, we meant it then. It turned out our suspicions were correct. They were more than reasonable. And guess what? Going to reasonableness are these subsequent events. Why is that analytically different from what you say is a different situation, which is that they didn't have a reasonable basis to have those concerns?
Because the first incident where they say there's another murder is they're trying to use this separate incident that happened to bolster their claim. And you can't bolster whether there was an exigency at the time by the fact that the defendant then did something else wrong. That's different than when you have the police making a claim, we had to act this way because there was a mad gunman on the loose and we were scared and we thought we were at risk, we thought the public was at risk. And then something happens in the close future that directly casts doubt on that.
Why is that different?
Because
both post events affect the prior decision. How is that any different?
They affect the credibility of the officer. So the second...
But doesn't the former?
No, a second murder doesn't affect the credibility of the officer. Sure the does. Officer...
Boy, I was right.
But that's not going to their credibility. That's after the fact justifying what they did. But whether there was another murder or not another murder doesn't make the officer more or less credible when he claimed he was acting. It maybe makes him right, but it doesn't make him more or less credible.
Wrong. Right versus wrong. Let me ask you one other question. How do you distinguish Rumenity, number one? And number two, have you ever heard of a CDW being granted over the phone?
I have not, but that is not very meaningful because I don't
just
have
ask
any experience with
just
that.
Just curious. Okay.
But no, I don't.
I'll ask your colleague. But how do you distinguish Rumenity?
I think here there's just such a complete lack of anything. And when the
Isn't
state
very-
says...
But isn't it, I'm just asking to distinguish it from the facts, because aren't the facts somewhat similar? And isn't the only distinction what happened after the fact here?
I think what happened after the fact is very relevant.
I'm not asking relevant. Is that the difference?
That is certainly a very significant difference.
If there was an after the fact event that affected the credibility of the officer's reasonableness determination at the time, and I'm not getting into whether that what that would be. Should that come in if that exists in a different case? See what I mean? In the next case, if a trial court were to assess an after-the-fact event to be relevant to the credibility of the officer's assessment at the time of the exigency determination, should that trial judge let that after-the-fact event in?
If it goes to the credibility of the officer's claim. And that's what it does here. That's the difference.
If it bolsters the credibility. I'm not getting into what it is.
Yeah,
I know you're making a good argument for your client, which is if it hurts the credibility, it comes in. If it bolsters, it shouldn't. But what if an after-the-fact event were to bolster the credibility of the officer? Should the trial court let that in?
If I were standing here and we had a situation where the police claimed exigency, and the police spent the next 48 hours searching everywhere, uncovering every rock, trying to find this defendant, I don't know that I'd have that good of an argument to say that that's not at least somewhat relevant to your consideration.
The distinction you're making, as I'm listening to you, is the distinction between a course of conduct on the part of police throughout, as opposed to some other external event that is being used to after the fact, collaterally attacked the police.
Right, some other event after the fact that would say, wow, you really must have been right, because he did go kill someone else. That is different than something that happens that goes to the credibility of what the officers are claiming precipitated their actions. They're claiming we had to act, we had no choice. We had an armed gunman on the loose. We had to get him, it was immediate. We couldn't get a warrant. And then for the next 2 days, you have the officers acting completely inconsistent with that.
So and I'll just finish and hand over to my colleague here. So if the officers continued to, after the exigency determination, if the officers continued to intensely look everywhere, that should come in.
I don't think it's determinative, but I don't know that I would have a very strong argument for saying that the court couldn't at least look at that.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Perrone, in the written application for exigency, there was reference to the defense, the suspect being armed, being dangerous. Later on now, we're hearing an amplification of that with regard to its relation to destruction of evidence. Tell us your position on what, if any, role, some would say speculation about destruction of evidence should play or could play in an exigency analysis.
None, when it's just mere speculation. There has to be a particularized, there's always the possibility that a defendant will destroy evidence, always. And that can't be a limiting principle. There has to be something particularized, some reason to believe. And the example I think Your Honor gave earlier, in a drug case, when they believe
burning
the defendant's-
body, perhaps?
I'm sorry?
Burning the body, perhaps?
I don't see how burning the body shows he didn't want to get caught. Most murderers, all murderers don't.
Not destroying evidence, ballistics, some type of bruising that might be attributable to, traceable to the defendant.
He's certainly trying to cover up what he did.
Suppose you had a case with 10 strands of evidence out there, and the suspect had already taken steps to destroy half of them. Would that be a basis to argue on the state's part destruction of evidence creates an exigency?
If they could point to particularized reasons to believe that there was additional evidence out there, specific evidence that they believe the defendant had the means and the intent to destroy, then yes.
How do they possibly know what that is at this stage? They find a body, they find an ID. You know, obviously you know the facts very well. How could they possibly be able to identify for a court, here is a list of evidence we think is out there that is in danger?
I think that's why this is a very narrow exception. I would imagine in most circumstances they can't do that. Then there's not exigent circumstances.
Would you say that if they can't make that application, they wouldn't have been able to make it under a warrant, so they can't do it under a warrant application? They shouldn't be able to do it under a claim of exigency?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Wouldn't the same kind of demonstration with particularity be necessary for a warrant application? And to just say, I have exigency, I don't have to show the same level of particularization under an exigency explanation, then we're divorcing the two?
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor.
The other piece of it is whether or not the time at which it would take to get the warrant is the breaking point. That if I go to get the warrant, it's going to get destroyed.
Correct.
There has to be a showing that the loss of time is really going to make a difference.
Exactly. So we really need to start with what it is, and then we need to know how, when, why we think that's going to be destroyed. We don't even know here the difference in time that it would have been between the exigent circumstances request and the warrant. So now we're speculating that some unknown piece of evidence could be destroyed at some unknown time, and some unknown additional amount of time that it takes to get a warrant would have made the difference.
But it wasn't unknown.
I'm sorry?
It wasn't unknown. They had talked to a number of witnesses along the line who had provided evidence that this defendant was the target. And you heard the state say, we were concerned he just killed his cousin and burned the body, and we were concerned about them.
It's a done act, right? There was a murder. There was a body burned. There's nothing that the state
you're
leads
asking,
to. I'm sorry.
You were asking about what are the things that were at risk. And the state stood up here for probably longer than they had to and said there was a burned body of his cousin who had been shot. And there were these other witnesses, because we have talked to him. They knew his whereabouts. They pretty much pointed the finger at him. Isn't that exactly what we're talking about, destruction of evidence? Not to mention the gun, which they never recovered. Isn't that exactly what they're talking about?
No, because there's no risk. That body was burned. That's done.
They have a gun. You could shoot the witness. You could set that body on fire.
But the majority of murders have a gun, and they could shoot a witness. There's always witnesses, or there's often witnesses.
I know, but you just said, what evidence, what is it that was at risk? And I'm just repeating what the state said. Aren't you ignoring that?
No. So the body's not at risk, right? We established that because it's done. What they did with the body, what was done with the body was done. So now the state needs to show what evidence is at risk of being destroyed.
Isn't that what they said? Other witnesses.
But there's no basis to conclude that. Because
if there had been no evidence of destruction of evidence in this case, you would step forward with a very reasonable argument and say this is complete speculation on the part of the state, correct? So here you have demonstrable evidence that's quite extreme. Doesn't that factor into whether there is a basis to assess destruction of evidence as one of the risks at stake?
There's nothing to show. So presumably any defendant is going to try to cover up the crime, whether it's burning the body, it's burying the body, it's disposing of the body in some way. And my position is, maybe it's particularly horrific that the body was burned, but that doesn't take us out of what Carpenter refers to as the mine run investigation. This is an investigation of something that already happened. And there's nothing to show for the police to point to with any type of particularity of what is going to happen in the future that is going to create the risk of destruction of evidence or injury to a witness. That's just pulled out of nowhere. There's nothing to turn to except the fact that there was a witness to suggest that the defendant was going to kill a witness. I mean, you could say any murder defendant would have an incentive to kill a witness. There has to be a limiting principle. And the state, as much as they talked about the burned body and that this isn't a man with a gun exception or this isn't a murder exception, in the end, that's exactly what they're asking this court for, because they have not offered any particularized suspicion. And without particularized suspicion, if all that you're relying on is that this was an offense committed with a gun and the murderer wasn't caught yet, then that's a murder exception to the exigent circumstances doctrine.
Ms. Prune, I want to come back to timing for a moment, timing with respect to obtaining a warrant. CDW warrants are technical warrants. You would agree with that, right?
Correct.
So they take some time to craft. However much time they take, that's a fair part of the analysis, correct?
If it were established in the record. I honestly don't know how much time they take.
The court can't, again, setting aside the precise number of minutes that it might take, however long it takes is a legitimate consideration in assessing exigency.
Correct.
And time for review would also be factored in as a legitimate concern in assessing exigency.
I think as long as it were established on the record that there is a time for review,
You don't think the court can't take notice that when we know these matters are going to be assessed down the road with care as they are right now, we don't want to have attorneys involved in reviewing?
They may have attorneys involved in reviewing. That very well may be the case. But I don't know that from this record. I don't know what the process would have been for them to obtain a warrant in this record.
But wasn't this judge the wiretap judge, and hadn't she done these kinds of warrants before? In other words, she talked briefly about the time it would take. Is the judge entitled to consider that in light of her experience?
I mean, I think certainly to answer your question and also what you were saying, Justice Ravner, sure, you can take into account that it's going to take longer to get a warrant than it's going to take to do an exigent circumstances.
No, but implicitly, this is the warrant judge. She knows what it takes to get it. Can't she take that into account? She made the judgment it would have taken a while. It would have taken time.
What does that mean?
I don't know. You have to ask her.
Does that mean that the 3 hours they had wasn't enough? Maybe it did take a while, but maybe they could have done it in 3 hours. Nothing in the record to show that they couldn't.
Should we be remanding to the judge to explain what she meant? It would have taken a long time?
No, the state had its opportunity to create a record to establish exigent circumstances, and they failed to do so. The state could have introduced evidence of how long it typically takes to obtain a warrant, and that it was more than 3 hours, and that they had to do it. They didn't do that.
Your argument, in a nutshell, is when this court issued its Earls decision, we were concerned about the privacy in location data, and we expected a warrant, and we can't have exigency blowing a hole in that expectation without really a good explanation for why it can't be met.
That is exactly my position, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Prune. Mr. Simmons.
May it please the court. What I'd like to focus the court's attention on are the exact evidence that we're talking about, because that really wasn't really discussed yet in argument. And I think it's highly relevant and points up the Achilles heel in the state's position. There were three pieces of evidence that the emergency application to the provider asked for: current real-time GPS location, historical location, and call records. Only one of those things has anything whatsoever to do with an exigency. There's no exigency for a call record. There's no exigency for historical records. Those have to do with solving crime. That has nothing to do with an exigency. So really, what the state is saying is, we wanted to find this guy. And Justice LaVecchia had asked the question, well, did you have probable cause to arrest this guy? Because if you had probable cause to arrest this guy, then why not get an arrest warrant for this guy? And then we wouldn't even be talking about any of this stuff. But they didn't have probable cause to arrest him. They suspected him. There was an ongoing investigation. And understandably, the police wanted to solve this crime.
But if the phone's turned off, doesn't historical cell site information tell you where he might be? Like, the phone went off at 15 minutes ago.
Yes.
We know where he was 15 minutes ago. Doesn't that help you find him?
It might help you find him,
and
but that's
not
what
GPS.
They asked for. That's not what they asked for. They asked for days worth of data.
I got you. But historical data in some fashion on cell site location might give you where he is.
I would agree, depending on when
it's not just GPS.
Okay. But when they made such an emergency application, they had no idea the phone was off. So when they made that application, they were seeking to solve the crime. They weren't saying to themselves, well, the phone may be off, so we need the historical data. They wanted days worth of data. It's not relevant to where you were 3 days ago in that application. There must be.
Your position was that only the current data would be relevant to finding him, but perhaps some historical data would be.
Depending on when the phone was turned off, I suppose one could logically take that information and extrapolate and maybe do a search for someone in that area. That would make logical sense.
What about the person he's called theoretically five times in 2 hours ago, the person he was on the phone with? Why wouldn't that person be cell phone number of that person in the call records be relevant to finding somebody who may be at large? In other words, this is the person he's been talking to all night. We can call that person and say, have you seen him? Is he with you?
I suppose it potentially could be relevant to that, or perhaps not relevant. But what the police were trying to do was to find him immediately under the exigency. That's what they're claiming, there's an exigency, but there really wasn't an exigency. There wasn't an exigency because exigency justifies the seizure of constitutionally protected information that is connected somehow to the exigency. There is no connection here between the exigency and the information sought. There is no danger that the drugs are going to be flushed down the toilet. There was no evidence that someone was being held hostage. There was no evidence of anything of that nature. So here there was no connection between a purported exigency and the need for this information to justify what the police did, even going beyond the absence in the record for a basis to say why it would take too long. Even going beyond that, the flaw in the state's argument is also reflected in the response to Your Honor's questioning this morning as to why they allowed him to take public transportation. And if the answer is, as the state gave today, well, the exigency dissipated at that point. Really? How did the exigency dissipate? The answer was, well, there were no more murders. How do we know that? There was no more murders in the state of New Jersey in the two-day period. There were no more murders in the state of New York in the two-day period. That makes no sense.
So you are arguing for after-the-fact evidence to be considered in the exigency analysis.
I think it belies the after-the-fact evidence, including the warrants that were made, the 28-page wiretap application that the state saw fit to do, the fact that the police allowed this guy to come in on his own. That after-the-fact evidence is highly relevant to belie the state's purported exigency here.
And if in a different case, after-the-fact evidence bolsters the credibility of the state's application, should that be allowed in?
Perhaps, but not under the example that Your Honor had given before.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying, you were saying that after-the-fact evidence that belies the credibility of the application should be allowed in.
I'm sorry, just let me finish. I apologize.
So if in fact, after-the-fact evidence bolsters the credibility of the state's presentation on exigency, should that be allowed in?
If, for example, the state's application says X, I'll give you an example. A witness said that the suspect was wearing a green shirt when he fled from such and such a location. And then they found out after the fact, days later, when they found the suspect and he happened to be wearing a green shirt. And then the application, the underlying application, and the credibility of the affiant or the witness is questioned based upon that application. I think it may be fair to say that you can't really go after the credibility of that witness without seeing the full scope of this.
I understand you're giving me an example of where it could be, but if in fact, after the fact information bolsters the credibility of the state's exigency presentation to the judge at the time, and you gave one example, but as a general proposition, should that also be admissible?
No. Because when one assesses the state's application, you need to know and to cabin what did the state know at that time.
Okay.
And either, as we know from other Fourth Amendment analysis, there may have been a very misleading presentation to a judge. There may have been material facts omitted from the application. But it's not fair to say, well, this person was prescient and they found out what they found out later, even though they fabricated to the judge before, they didn't know about that, but they were prescient and they got it right. I don't think that's fair.
The distinction, I take it, is there's a difference between after-the-fact information and a course of conduct on the part of police that undermines the credibility of their statement that there was an objectively reasonable exigency.
Correct. What I find troubling in the state's position here is there is no limitation. There is no limitation and no requirement that the evidence seized have any connection to the exigency or really be at risk of being lost. And this is a perfect example, this case. You have information being held by a cell phone provider, safely secured by a cell phone provider. This is not a connection case where the police have to bust down a door to prevent the drugs from being destroyed. That is a quintessential example of when an exigency may be relevant here. There is no evidence of that here. The purported exigency, I guess, relates to the police desire, one, to find this person who is a person of interest, for whom they did not yet have an arrest warrant, or to actually solve this crime. And then once they did the exigency applications to the provider and got the information, they used that information to bootstrap their later applications, which they spent apparently hours doing. They felt it was not an emergent situation. They would sit and listen to a wiretap, I guess. They thought that was not only to make the wiretap application, but they thought that was the way to go in this investigation. And then days later, after they did that, and Mr. Manning called them, they said, here, why don't you take New Jersey Transit or the PATH and come on in and we'll talk to you when you get here. That belies any notion of exigency.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Miller, rebuttal? And as part of your rebuttal, can you address Mr. Sinan's argument that the material sought went beyond that which would bear on exigency?
Sure.
Call records, et cetera.
Sure. Well, first, the GPS location, that was imminent, that was temporal, that could have been destroyed at any moment. But you need to request all these records all together for them to make sense. The case cited by the state in our brief to this court, U.S. v. Caraballo, the state requested the CSI, the call detail records, the subscriber information, in addition to the GPS location. And you need this information in order for the GPS location to make any sense. You know, the subscriber information for this number, turned out the phone was not actually registered to defendant. Police were able to find out that it was his girlfriend's phone, but it's possible that they had the wrong number. The danger inherent in locating the wrong person who you suspect to be an armed murderer, once you have their GPS location, it's unreasonable to request just the GPS by itself.
How many days or what time period for the call records and the historical location information were sought?
There wasn't a request for days. They requested the day prior and the day of the request for the call cell site location data. As this court mentioned in Earls in covering how this CSLI works, it can give you the meters to where the individual is located. It could be he's still there, as Justice Solomon pointed out. It could be that he never left the neighborhood where the abandoned body and vehicle was found. Police did not know that. It's very possible he was holed up in a house in that neighborhood or engaged in some type of carjacking to get out of there. Police didn't know how he got out of there. It's an incredibly odd area to leave a burned body in an abandoned vehicle. Police reasonably thought that others might be in danger. For those reasons, and the call detail records, you know, the cell site location data and the call detail records, they kind of operate together. The cell site location data often shows that a number was dialed at a certain point, and when that number was dialed, then the phone hit off a cell phone tower. So, you know, the information is all interrelated. Requesting the GPS information, sure.
Are you arguing, I don't think you are, but are you arguing that the police had probable cause to believe that he had committed the crime at the time that they sought the exigency CDW warrant?
I believe that they did have probable cause.
So you believe that they had probable cause to arrest him then?
I do, Your Honor.
And so why didn't they go out and arrest him?
They didn't know where defendant was. There's nothing in the record that shows that they knew defendant's location. That's why they requested the GPS information so they could find him. And that plays into the phone call days
later. After they got that information, did they go out and try to arrest him?
Again, the assistant prosecutor during this motion hearing reasonably focused on everything the police knew at the time when they made the exigency request. Then the testimony stops. This telephone call that has now taken raised importance 2 days later, where defendant volunteered to turn himself in, you know, the witness wasn't even a party to that telephone call. That telephone call was raised by the defense to say that there was never an exigency and that the more proper course of police conduct would have been to call defendant at the jump and ask him to turn himself in. So for those,
where he lived?
There's nothing, the defendant's address was hard to pinpoint at this time. The Dunbar said that he resided somewhere in Brooklyn. It turned out that he also had an Englewood residence associated with his records that the police looked up later, but police weren't able to find him at that point.
Is it possible that they decided it was safer for the public and safer for officers to have him come to the police station where he would not presumably get through with a weapon on him than to go out there in a residential area somewhere and try to arrest him?
That's correct, Your Honor. And at the time the phone call was made, this witness wasn't a party to the phone call where defendant offered to turn himself in. It's nowhere in the record that defendant suggested, why don't you come get me now? I'll turn myself in right now. Here's where I'm located right now. There's nothing in this record that suggests that police delayed at all, and it was a reasonable decision to have him turn himself in without alerting to him that he was the prime suspect at that moment.
Are you suggesting that that was done intentionally, or are you answering the question, is it possible that, as a speculation on this record, that's what was going on?
It's possible, based on this record, but the suggestion by defense counsel that that police did nothing for 2 days when they had these cell phone records. That is nowhere in this record, and that is a completely unreasonable assumption.
There's nothing in the record on that. I'm sorry, Chief, go ahead.
No, please.
Sorry.
The concern that I think you've heard voiced is not that the police were doing nothing, but that you have an individual who is considered armed and extremely dangerous at the time the application, the records are sought without a warrant, but seemingly is not considered that way 2 days later.
I'm not sure if that what's described of that phone call reveals that. That may have been the earliest time they could get him to turn himself in. There's nothing in that phone call that he said, I'm located right here, or I'm willing to come in right now. That may have been the earliest time they were able to apprehend him. There's no indication they knew where he was and purposely didn't go get him or delayed the interview. I think those assumptions are not supported by the record here. And
isn't the question really on the phone when the police are talking to him, tell us where we are, we'll come and get you and save you the ride in?
That's not clear whether he told them where he was.
No, but isn't that the question?
We don't know from this record.
Rather than saying, you know, get on public transportation and come in tomorrow, wouldn't the proper question would have been, tell us where you are and we'll come and get you and bring in?
We don't know if police asked that question or not.
No, I they didn't, apparently.
They might have. This witness wasn't party to that telephone call. This telephone call is referenced very tangentially in the record that we have before this court, and is now taken outsized importance. And the state submits, that's not really fair. That's not really the way the defense was couching that telephone call.
Clarify who you're identifying when you say this witness.
Detective Frazier. He was not the party to the phone call with the defendant when he called. That was Detective, I believe it was Detective Gary Bosch at the time. A different point of contention regarding this record is that the police didn't do anything when they found out defendant's phone number and that defendant had given an impossible location for him the prior day. The record reveals that conversation happened in Brooklyn with detectives between 4:30 and 5 p.m. That information had to make it back to the to Lieutenant Anzalotti, who was the point person for the investigation, back down to Detective Frazier, who was mapping the victim's cell phone records at the time. And the Detective Frazier still had to identify the license at that point as belonging to the defendant. And police took the time to verify Manning's phone number with Stout's mother. So police didn't get this information leading to Manning, to defendant, and his number, and then wait until 7:30. They were conducting this investigation, and it took time for this evidence to make its way from Brooklyn back to Paramus and to make sense to the officers who eventually filed the exigent circumstances request form.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you to all.